Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Gary Wachner. He coordinates the Save the Colorado River campaign, whose mission is to protect and restore the Colorado River and its tributaries from the source to the sea. He's worked in government, academia, and advocacy for 30 years as an award-winning environmental activist and writer based in Fort Collins, Colorado. So thank you so much for your work, and thank you for being on the program.
It's my pleasure to be here, Derek, and thank you for doing the program and giving me a call.
Oh, thanks. I guess my first question is just let's presume that people who are listening are on our side, whatever that means, and let's also presume they don't know a lot about the Colorado, either historically or currently. So can you start just by telling us about the Colorado River?
Sure. The Colorado River is one of the most beautiful rivers in the United States and maybe in the world. Starts in the Rocky Mountains of Colorado. It also starts in Utah and Wyoming and in New Mexico, and it flows throughout the Southwest U.S. through many national parks, including Grand Canyon, and then flows down through a series of dams and reservoirs and goes intermittently to the Gulf of California. In addition to being a beautiful river and one of the centerpieces of the United States National Park System, the Southwest U.S., it's also one of the most dammed and diverted rivers on the planet. There are more dams and diversions than almost any river anywhere. There's massive reservoirs. There's endangered fish. There's all sorts of serious problems with the river. It's one of the most endangered rivers in America, as determined by another national environmental group. And there are multiple new threats of more dams and diversions on the river. So it's a beautiful river, and there is a big sort of, story around the Colorado River that is certainly a bit schizophrenic in that there's good and bad around it. One of the things about the Colorado River is because it's been so dammed and diverted is that there is kind of, you can only go up from here. And so there is a little bit of optimism that things can't get a whole lot worse, or we can at least stop them from getting worse and hopefully make them a little bit better by providing more flows in the river, by helping it reach its terminus in the sea, and by making it healthier for the non-human world, fish, wildlife, etc.
Let's talk for a minute about the pre-dams and pre-contact, pre-conquest, Colorado. It's the biggest river in the Southwest, right? And one of the
biggest river in the Southwest. On an average year, it has about 5 trillion gallons of water flowing into it and down it. And of course, that used to flow all the way into Mexico and to the Gulf of California. And created a 2 million acre wetland, one of the biggest in North America, where it used to reach the sea. Of course, before people started, dam and diverting it, it was spectacular. A river that, of course, carved the Grand Canyon and a lot of the canyon country in Utah, and created some of the most beautiful places on the planet.
And created lots of unique habitat for all sorts of creatures, including humans.
Yes, that's true. The river, there's a lot of species that are unique to the river and the ecosystem around the river. And of course, then when people showed up and started damming and diverted it, it now provides water to all of Southern California, most of Arizona, including all the 7 states in the Southwest U.S. and a huge area in the northern part of Mexico near the Mexicali region. And so it is a huge source of water for people and cities, and a massive source of water for agriculture right now, where almost all the crops that are grown in the Southwest U.S. Are grown with Colorado River water, and they feed the entire nation. So you have this complicated story of environmental chaos, of blooming in the desert, of feeding society, at the same time of draining and destroying this river. And it all weaves throughout the history of the American West, as in cultural and environmental.
So let's talk about the history of damming. When did the damming really start? And then you said it's the most dammed river in the United States, or one of the most. And can you talk about, so the history of damming and then the current situation with how many dams, how many big dams really? Cause I'm sure there's a ton of tiny dams too. How many fairly big dams? How many? And then you've said several times that, it either intermittently reaches the ocean. You talked about it used to reach the ocean. So we have this major river that no longer reaches the ocean. So can you talk about the history and then bring us up to the present with this?
Sure. There are five big dams on the Colorado River system. The biggest, of course, is Hoover Dam, which is has Lake Mead behind it, and it's right there near Las Vegas. And it was built in the 1930s, and it still is the largest reservoir in the United States when it's full. Right now it's way less than half full. And then the second biggest reservoir and dam is Lake Powell and Glen Canyon Dam, which is on the Arizona-Utah border, and that was built in the late 1950s. And then there's three other sort of smaller dams, one's in Wyoming, one's in Colorado, and one's in New Mexico. All five of those make up what they call the Colorado River Storage Project, which stores all the water in the river. But the big ones are Mead and Glen Canyon Dam and Hoover Dam. And the river no longer reaches the sea. There was a little bit of a pulse flow. We can talk about that if you like later in the show. Back in January and February, there was a historic agreement that came together between the United States and Mexico to let a little bit of water out of Lake Mead and Hoover Dam and run all the way down to Mexico. But for the most part, all 5 trillion gallons are sucked up by people and farms or evaporate into the air every year. And there are a lot of problems with Colorado River because of human overuse.
And let's go either direction here. Do you want to talk about the problems, or do you want to talk about the prior use process of water appropriation and how that's kind of a mess?
Well, there are lots of problems, and we've kind of hit on those in terms of flows in the river are a problem. Water quality is a problem in the river because there's so little water in it sometimes and most of the time. There's major problems with dams and diversions. And then there's a problem in that, of course, the river is sucked completely dry before it reaches the sea. And so, that's an easier story to tell. The story of water rights in the Southwest U.S., it really originated in the 1800s. A lot of it was because of the mining industry, and water was, there was no sense of environmental ethic or recreational ethic like we have now. And so people established what's called rights to use water, and they could take all the water out of the river if they want. And they do that routinely still throughout the Southwest U.S. And so, there's a long story there about water rights. One of the main issues with the Colorado River is it's really hard, like a lot of environmental problems that we face right now, it's really sort of easy to see a dark hat and a white hat and who's wrong and who's right. The Colorado River, it's a little bit more of a gray area because this has been going on for so long. There's an entire system of culture and agriculture and people and government that is invested in the system the way it is. And so some of the real, fascinating challenges are how to change it a little bit or a lot to get a better situation for the river. And so it's sometimes more of a complicated issue than a lot of other environmental issues because it's already bad. And the question is how to make it worse or how to make it better. And how to work with all the various institutions and power, people of power, and the governments to try to move the ball down the field.
Well, and we can certainly go that direction. I'm happy to. I would, of course, argue that that the part of the problem, in fact, I'm writing a book right now on human supremacism. I'm almost done with it. And one of the things I'm dealing with in the book a lot is this is a notion, and the whole water rights thing applies to this, because one of the words that's really central to this is beneficial uses. And I find it quite extraordinary. So basically, people can take water from the river for, quote, beneficial uses. But part of the problem is, like you said, that when this notion was developed, this culture is so incredibly human supremacist that actually water for fish or for wetlands is not a beneficial use, as opposed to growing citrus in Arizona, or for that matter, running a fountain in Las Vegas.
Yeah, the way I like to use to tell a story is that the water has rights, but the river has none. So in the Southwest U.S. and most states, and certainly in Colorado, you can drain a river completely bone dry. You can kill every single thing in it, and you've violated no law, generally speaking. And so there are rights established around the water for humans to use that water for a quote-unquote beneficial use. But the river and most of the species in it have no right whatsoever to exist. Now, that there's a one little caveat there, in that the Endangered Species Act, which was passed by Congress back in the 70s, does require have water rights attributed to trying to keep species alive. Long story in the Southwest U.S. and the Colorado River system about how water has been used to try to keep a few species alive. But in general, you're exactly right. And the Colorado River system and all of the tributaries to it are a perfect example of how rivers and species in them have no legal right to exist under American law.
Okay, so now that we've talked about that, can you talk about some of the – actually, let's go one more direction before we talk about any sort of attempts to make things better. That we hear a lot here in the West about how the reservoirs are at their lowest. You said it was 50% capacity. And so what does this what do you think is the short term? Okay, let's pretend that nothing good happens legislatively with the Colorado River for a little while. What do you see as the short to medium term future of both the river and the reservoirs, given the droughts, global warming, and the overuse of the river already? So if things continue as business as usual, what do you see with the Colorado River?
Yeah, right now, the two largest reservoirs, Lake Mead is around 38 or 39% full, and I think Lake Powell is around 50% full, or under 50, maybe 45, something like that. And so basically every year, the Southwest U.S. is in an extended drought. Some people would argue that climate change is already here and it already exists, and that's what this drought really is. You can go back and forth on that. But the bottom line in all of that is that we're taking about a million acre feet, or about 1/13 of the river, we're taking out more every year than flows in. And so they call this a structural deficit, which means that's why the lakes are going down. So in other words, we're diverting more water out every year than goes in. To answer your question, like, well, what happens if business as usual? What would happen is that the lakes would continue to drop, and what's driving a lot of the system is partly about the water supply in the lakes, the reservoir levels, but it's also about the generation of electricity. Both Hoover Dam and Glen Canyon Dam are hydroelectric facilities. And so one of the perceived threats is that they will drop what's called below power pool and quit generating electricity. And that electricity is highly subsidized and cheaper than a lot of other sources right now. So that could happen. One of the other things that's likely to happen, though, is that, there's always this talk about the crisis on the Colorado River, and that cities are going to run out of water. I mean, that's less likely to happen because cities have a lot of money, and farmers have a lot of water, and there are somewhat easy and mechanisms for cities to buy water from farmers. And so what you will see, and what you do see right now, but you'll continue to see, is less water going for agriculture and more water going for cities. So you'll see that happening if business as usual continues, and you'll also see the lakes drop below what's called power pool to the point where they may quit generating electricity.
And when at the current rate, this is something I've never quite understood. So let's pretend that the current rates of dropping continue. How long would that, how long would it take before the reservoir is essentially dry? And I recognize it's going to be, you know, asymptotic. So just pretend it isn't. How many years worth of water is still in the reservoir is really the question.
Yeah, and it's actually a hard question because the seven states in the Southwest U.S. have a number of agreements, and in 2007 they negotiated a new agreement as they saw this situation approaching, so that when the levels get to a certain when the lakes get to a certain level, Arizona is going to start having mandatory water restrictions. When they get to a next level, some of the other states will have mandatory water restrictions. When they get to a next level, California will have mandatory water restrictions, and so there's somewhat of a plan in place to address the issue of the continually falling lake levels. So that is moving forward. That process is in play. And the predictions that I've seen are that next year or the year after, one of the lakes could get to the point where it triggers a restriction in water use in Arizona, which would get triggered first because they have the lowest water right. All that gets a little wonky, but it is complicated. And of course, the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation and the seven states realize this, and they are trying to do something about it. And they do have some plans in place, and there's other plans moving forward now. And so, the next 2 to 5 years are going to be really a fascinating time in the history of the Colorado River to see what can be done and who does what to address this looming threat.
So, from the perspective of the river itself and from the non-humans whose lives depend on it, what are some of the actions that are either being taken or are being planned to help the natives? You talked about the pulse. So can you talk about that? And then can you talk about other, you said that we're at the bottom. And so, you know, talk about some of the good things that you and other people are attempting to help bring about.
Sure. And I want to be clear too that, you know, when people talk about the Colorado River, the vast majority of the conversation is about the water supply. My organization is about saving the river and the species in it. And so we try to focus on that. And so, because not that the other issues are important, but there are plenty of other people which have extraordinary resources to focus on those issues. And so as change comes about, what my organization tries to do is make sure that that change happen in a way that's beneficial to the river and non-human species in it, in addition to all the other stakeholders. So there's a few things that are going on right now. One of the big ones was, my organization was a really small player in this. There were some other organizations that were the main players, was the Pulse Agreement that happened back in January and February. So the United States and Mexico reached an historic agreement, and the seven states and all the water providers reached an historic agreement to let some water flow out of Hoover Dam and flow back into the Colorado River Delta, where it no longer meets the sea. And so for about a 2-month period, the gates in the Lassa Dam on the river down the Morales Dam on the U.S.-Mexico border were also opened, and water flowed down in the main channel of the Colorado River where it hadn't flowed in 20 years. And that was one thing that we were involved with, helping to promote, helping to support, helping to reach out to decision makers to try to help tell that story and move that forward. One of the other things that we have done really actively is help fight new water projects. So at the same time where the river is already in bad shape, there's a bunch of new proposals for more dams and diversions. And we have jumped into those skirmishes pretty aggressively, try to stop some of those projects. There was a big one proposed up in Wyoming around the Flaming Gorge Reservoir to pipe water 500 miles across Wyoming down to Denver area. There's two right here in Colorado. One's for Denver area, one's for northern Colorado. We're trying to stop those. And there's another diversion proposed out of Lake Powell in southwest Utah to get more water out of the river there. So we've jumped into those skirmishes to try to stop bad water projects. So supporting water in the Delta, stopping bad water projects. And we also get very involved in trying to help promote water conservation in cities throughout the southwest U.S. And there's a lot of cities and a lot of issues around that. Those are kind of the three things that we get involved in a lot.
Wait a second. You just said that – you said a few minutes ago that the water is, under current flows, is already – did you say 13% overallocated, 17% overallocated, some percent overallocated? And
about 113 right now about 13.5 million acre feet flow down the river, and a million more is coming out every year. So that would be, yeah, around – 15% overallocated, yes.
Okay, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't it kind of crazy to have it already overallocated? They've already allocated more than exists, and they want to take out more?
In my opinion, it is crazy, and I think that is kind of an accurate word. Here's sort of what's going on. In the Colorado River Basin, there's like the upper basin and the lower basin. The lower basin states are Arizona and California and Nevada, and the upper basin states are Wyoming, Colorado, New Mexico, and Utah. And they each of those upper basins and lower basins gets a certain amount of water that they have to share. They're constantly feuding about if they're getting as much water as they have a right to. In addition to that, in the upper basin, all four of the states are all constantly feuding with each other about whether they who has rights to the water and whether they should get more. And in addition to that, in each state, like Colorado, like the state of Colorado, the cities are constantly feeding each other, trying to get the last legally allowed drop of water out of the river. So at the same time where it's already overallocated and it's a huge problem, there's a big battle on to try to get the last legally allowed drops, which will, of course, make the situation worse. So one of the clear things that I think need to be done, and we try to do, is to stop new water projects out of the Colorado River system, because obviously you can't, if someone's bleeding out, you can't fix them by cutting another artery, and that's what these proposed water projects would do.
Yeah. Let's go back to the pulse, and can you tell me some of the positive effects? I've seen some videos of the water first running down, and I was sobbing as I was watching the videos. And can you tell me some of the positive effects for some of the non-humans of the pulse? What difference did it make?
Sure. And I was fortunate enough to have the time to go down there during the pulse flow. It was about a week after they let the water out. And I got to spend about a day walking along the leading edge of the river as it was just literally ambling its way across the sand. And I didn't sob, but I just want to be quite frank. It was a little bit of an overwhelming experience just to like walk along with that river, where there was no river in front of you and there was a river behind you, and it was just edging its way through the sand. It was really quite remarkable, and I'm sure you've seen some of those videos online. They purposely timed the pulse, and it's a fairly intricate scientific experiment to coincide with the timing of the release of cottonwoods seedlings down there and a number of other ecological events to see if they could bring water back to that, you know, completely deserted area, and if the delta and the river basin there, at least in the small area, would come back to life. And some of the initial signs and reports were really kind of remarkable, that cottonwoods are dropping their seeds, that beavers showed up out of nowhere, and bird species came back to the river. And it was really quite remarkable in terms of the environmental benefits that, obviously, if you completely drain and destroy a river and then you put some water back in, it's going to make a big difference. And it did make a big difference.
You know, it always, one of the few things that actually brings me any sort of optimism at all is how much life wants to live and how, you know, when there's dam removal, it's extraordinary how fast the salmon or the alewives or the eels come back and then everyone else. Actually, this all raises another question that we haven't talked about yet, which is what about the effects of a lack of flooding on the Grand Canyon and the attempts to do artificial floods? Can you talk about that?
Sure, and I'm not an expert on that, but I'll certainly give you a little bit overview of it and my kind of opinion. The Grand Canyon is one of the most degraded ecosystems in the United States right now. It used to have water which came down the Colorado River, which was warm, and it was brown and muddy and filled with sediment and filled with native species and native species insects and all sorts of critters that grow and live in that kind of environment. When they put in Glen Canyon Dam, of course, it stopped everything, and then they let water out of the dam at a lower spot on the dam where it's cold and clear. And so the Grand Canyon is a completely changed ecosystem from what it was naturally. And this is kind of funny, and it's an interesting little story, because sometimes you'll see reporters write about the Grand Canyon, and they'll talk about this beautiful, crystal clear water and this, you know, sparkling environment. And basically that is, you know, that means environmental destruction, because the water used to be warm and muddy and filled with sediment and native species. And in the Grand Canyon, it is a completely altered system right now. There have been a number of attempts to deal with that by letting more water out, and then some scientific studies of the sandbars and see if they've gotten better or worse, and some studies of the fish populations. It's my opinion, from looking at all those studies, that basically none of the efforts that have happened have worked very well, and the Grand Canyon continues to decline in terms of ecological health.
You know, this is one of the things that kills me about all of this, and it doesn't matter whether we're talking about this or logging or global warming or anything else, that there's this notion that that by simply trying to mimic one little part of what the real world does, then somehow that makes all the theft of water or trees or whatever okay, and it somehow is going to make up for it. But, you know, just last night or 2 days ago, I was reading this thing that they are now discovering that ants make limestone by they eat other stuff and then essentially sequester carbon. And they don't know whether they vomit it up or poop it out or do what, but they don't know how, but they make limestone and sequester tremendous amounts of carbon. And the point here is I love this line by David Ehrenfeld: the world is not only more complex than we think, it's more complex than we're capable of thinking. And so what I'm getting at is a long way of saying that it annoys me that they think that you can put up dams, take all the water out of the river, and then once in a while send some artificial floods down. And yeah, I guess that's better than nothing. But the notion that could replicate what the real world actually does, it just seems really arrogant to me.
You know, my response to that would be, we human critters think we're amazingly clever, but history and time has proven otherwise, and I would argue that it's going in the wrong direction. You know, I would agree with you. And so, you know, 50 years ago, they built this massive concrete dam, and it is a monolith of cement. And through a series of lawsuits, they were forced to try to do some little tweaks to, you know, help the Grand Canyon. You know, I would argue that those tweaks aren't working at all. Some people would argue that they have made a difference, but that's kind of where it's at right now. It is, it's a mess.
And how long under the industrial best case scenario, which is not the river best case scenario, but from the perspective of those who think the dams are the greatest things in the world, how much longer, what is the lifetime of those dams? How long are they supposed to last?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm an expert on that. I mean, one of the biggest problems with the Glen Canyon Dam is the sediment that is pouring into it. It's something like, I don't know, 18,000 railroad cars per day of sediment fill Lake Powell behind Glen Canyon Dam. And there will be a sediment, it'll sediment over eventually. I think it's in the 100 or 200 years time span though. And the Bureau says, well, that's someone's problem in the future, not ours, is really where the federal government came out on that. You know, the dam, Glen Canyon Dam almost failed in one of the historic floods back in the 1980s because the water was so much water it overtopped the dam. And they started letting it out through the tubes on the side of the dam, which became eroded, and the dam started vibrating. And so, you know, there are people who would argue, and argue very effectively and scientifically, that what may be the end of the Colorado River dam system is not so much drought, but just one epic flood, because they may have only engineered those dams to handle like a 50-year flood, a flood that's likelihood of 1 in 50, and a flood that happens out of 1 out of 100 years or 1 out of 500 years could be devastating. And you know, what we're seeing in the Southwest U.S. with climate change is we're seeing, of course, just what you'd have to call climatic variability. Here along the Front Range of Colorado, where I live, we had in the last 5 years, we've had enormous floods, we've had enormous wildfires, we've had enormous snowpack and enormous droughts. It's been 5 years of record extremes almost in every single natural category. And so we don't know what's going to happen, whether what climate change is going to bring us. And I would bring that back to the concept of us humans thinking we're incredibly clever, but I think that history and time may prove otherwise, and perhaps cataclysmically.
So we've talked about, and thank you for all this, and we've talked about sort of business as usual, what will happen, and we've talked about how the river was, and we just right then talked about a dam failure. But if we let's pretend that the dam doesn't fail, and let's pretend that it's not quite business as usual. What would be your realistic, politically realistic, not realistic as in real,
sure,
I mean, what would be best realistically would be for the dams to disappear completely. But in terms of politically realistically, what are your best hopes for the short to middle term for the Colorado and the whole, then for the Colorado River and its non-human inhabitants?
Right. So great question. Just literally, last week, beginning of last week, the seven states reached a somewhat of an agreement, and four of the major cities that provide water in the Colorado River Basin, Southern California, Arizona, and Denver, reached a major agreement to start addressing this issue more proactively. And they threw some money into a pot, and basically they're going to start buying water from farmers in the upper basin, which is, you know, Colorado, Wyoming, New Mexico, Utah, and running it down the river to start refilling those reservoirs. Now, that raises a huge issue of whether it's smart to refill those reservoirs or not, or whether we're propping up the system that can't be sustained. But as that moves forward, again, part of what I'm trying to do is focus on the health of the river. And so if we can get more water flowing in the river, it's probably going to be better on the long term. So, you know, the cities and the states and the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation know there's a serious problem. And frankly, a lot of that sort of leadership, which helped push this awareness of the problem, came out of the when former Secretary of Interior Ken Salazar was there, because he was strongly interested in the Colorado River, and it was a big part of his work as Secretary of Interior, just to raise the awareness and try to get people to do something about it. And you can argue about whether it's going in the right direction or the wrong direction, but there's a big awareness and there are things moving forward. There's also the agreement between the United States and Mexico is also being, that's a 5-year agreement. It's called, it's a minute between the two countries, in the treaty between the two countries. They are also renegotiating that right now in hopes of getting more water and also trying to get a permanent flow of water, not just a pulse. And, you know, frankly, organizations like ours and others are also being affected and, at least temporarily stopping more diversions out of the river. And so, you know, as I said, several minutes ago, one of the things about the Colorado River, it's such in bad shape right now that it can only get better. And so, hopefully there are some things moving forward that are better.
You know, I'm going to go a different direction for a second and then come back to what you just said. And that's, you know, when we talked about the harm that's been done, something that I've thought about a little bit, but I haven't researched much, is that dewatering a river obviously harms the river, but that also has to have had a huge effect on the Gulf of California, has it not?
And there's two things there. One is, if you go down to the Colorado River Delta, where it used to be 2 million acres, and 2 million acres is a lot of land. It's a huge swath of land that used to be a vibrant wetland. Now it is bone dry desert, almost far as you can see. And it's really kind of startling to stand there and see it. In addition, 5 trillion gallons of fresh water used to flow into the Gulf of California every year. That doesn't happen anymore. There are endangered species and species that have gone extinct in the upper Gulf, in part because of this problem. The country of Mexico does not have an Endangered Species Act, and so it's not really addressed down there. You know, there's one of the most endangered whale species in the world. It's called the vaquita, and it is in the northern reaches of the Gulf of California. It's seriously threatened by gill netting, but it's also threatened because of water quality issues, in part because the Colorado River no longer comes there anymore. And so there's a lot of stuff going on down in the Delta and in Mexico that are, seriously degraded.
So we have about 5 minutes left. And if people are listening to this interview and they would like to do something to help the Colorado, can you give two options for the people as to what they would do? And the option one would be people who live in the Colorado River Basin, what would you suggest that they do? And people who don't live in the Colorado River Basin, what would you suggest they do to help the Colorado?
Sure. I the biggest problem with the Colorado River is just awareness, because although it provides water to almost 40 million people, it actually flows through almost no one's town. It flows through a few towns in Colorado, and they're smaller. It doesn't flow through Las Vegas. It doesn't flow through San Diego or Los Angeles or Phoenix or Tucson. So people don't know where their water comes from. And so public education is a huge problem and a huge opportunity, just trying to let people know that you turn on the tap, the water comes from a river, and that river is severely endangered. And so there are a number of environmental groups that are trying to focus on public education, including mine, Save the Colorado, savethecolorado.org. We send out email blasts once a week to a massive number of people. People can certainly join that, and we'll do whatever we can to help continue to educate people and provide opportunities for them to reach out to elected decision makers and tell them that they either did something good or they did something bad, or we need to change this or do that. So we're trying to do what we can. And there are a number of other environmental groups that are trying to do that too. And, you know, one of the big questions, though, is always, what can we do to help? And it's a really complicated answer, because it's 7 states, it's 2 countries, it's 40 million people, 75% of the water goes for agriculture, and it's just hard to come up with opportunities and specific concrete situations that people can do. But stay in touch with the organizations that are addressing this issue, including mine, and we'll do what we can to keep you informed.
Okay, well, thank you so much. Thank you for being on the show today, and thank you especially for your work in defense of the Colorado.
Thank you, Derek.
And I would like to thank people for listening. My guest today has been Gary Walkner. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.